So you've seen a migration out of farming communities because there's no jobs. And so now there's not even a grocery store in a lot of these little towns in West Texas. And so the demise of small rural communities has been one of the outcomes of the implementation and the adoption of GMOs. And so when you think about the true cost of what this has meant to farmers and lower profitability in many instances, being on a chemical treadmill, the loss of jobs in rural communities, then, you know, I think organic agriculture, on the other hand, brings all that back, that it really could help stop that urban migration.
Welcome to Mindful Businesses, presented by Sarani, and I'm your host, Vidya Iyer. In our podcast, we bring to you brands which are mindful in their practices and processes. A mindful business adopts and employs sustainable social, economic, and environmental practices. Today, we have with us Larae Pepper, Managing Director and Co-Founder of the Textile Exchange. Our guests are entrepreneurs who have started traditional for-profit businesses. Ms. Pepper is unique and, in my opinion, groundbreaking in her efforts in bringing organic cotton back to the United States. Welcome, Larae.
It's such a pleasure to be here with you, and I look forward to exploring, this journey to organic cotton and more regenerative solutions in the cotton world.
So let's start at the very beginning. Cotton has such a deep history in the wars, civil wars, in the freedom struggles. How and when did cotton come to the United States?
As you mentioned, cotton has a long history in the world because it goes back to days in Egypt and the old worlds and countries and things like that. And in Latin America, cotton has a long history in the world. And certainly in the United States, it goes back to the very beginning when it was settled in the 1800s and things like that. So, and it's grown. Cotton has to be grown where it's hot. You have to have heat units to make cotton, especially longer staple cotton. And so all around the Mediterranean, like around the equator areas, of course, India has a strong reputation and parts of China as well. So you have to have those heat units. So where it's hot, I think cotton is grown in over 63 different countries. In the United States, it's that southern stretch all the way from Southern California all the way over to Florida. So strong and rich history of cotton in a lot of rural communities around the world.
So this beautiful material is steeped in colonialism, slavery, and capitalism, especially in the U.S. context, right?
Indeed. Because even now, cotton is a pretty intensive crop. And in those early days before there were tractors and around the world, it's still a very labor intensive crop. And in some regions, very chemically intensive as well. And so, but cotton is one of those dynamic fibers. It brings so many positive things to communities as well. It's a cash crop. It also, by weight, the majority of the harvest is seed, and that seed goes into oils and cattle feed. Many times the stalks are harvested for kitchen fires when you're in Turkey or Uganda and parts of India and other places. And so the cotton plant's a very versatile crop. It can be grown in small amounts of rainfall as well as higher volumes of rainfall and in irrigation settings. And so it's a very versatile crop. But you're right, it is steeped in controversy from, labor practices even now, forced labor situations in other countries, as well as, like you said, there's a lot of controversy when it comes to labor in cotton and chemicals in cotton.
So one of the essential things for cotton was labor. And that created this whole system of slavery in the United States, in southern United States.
Well, I wouldn't say that cotton created slavery. I think slavery was there and it was used in all kinds of agricultural crops and even factory and other settings. And so certainly cotton was a very labor-intensive crop in those early years and still is in many countries. It's hand-harvested and hand-planted. So it is a labor-intensive crop. The United States, of course, has evolved in many places to use a lot of mechanical tractors and harvesting and things like that. So it's very mechanical right now and not as labor intensive in the United States. But the majority of the cotton grown is still very labor intensive and hand harvested.
And it may come as a surprise to many of our listeners that US, I believe, is the largest producer of cotton in the world.
It kind of depends upon the year. There's a three-way. China, India, and the United States, followed closely by Brazil, are the top growing countries in the world right now. So it kind of depends upon the year and the harvest and prices of cotton. It'll rotate into soy or corn or, you know, other crops. So usually U.S. is in the top three.
Especially because you don't think of the U.S. economy as being primarily agrarian. Like, for instance, India, still about 65% of the population, the jobs they have it in the agricultural sector.
That's certainly very true. There's, you know, fewer jobs right now in the ag sectors in the United States simply because so much of it has gone to, you know, more mechanized solutions.
So most of our listeners have never had the opportunity to see or visit a cotton farm or a cotton field.
Hmm.
Could you explain how the cotton from the plant is converted into fiber and sure. Fabric.
Well, it'd be great to take you on a journey of what actually happens in a field and turns a little seed into like a t-shirt or a pair of socks. So cotton takes about a year to grow. So for us in West Texas, where I grew up, that means we're going to plant when the soil temperatures are high enough sometime in May and we get a planting rain. And it'll mature and grow sometime until September, October. As organic farmers, we wait until we get a hard freeze because cotton is actually a little tree or a little bush that, you know, loses its leaves when you get a hard freeze. So as organic farmers, we wait for that freeze so we don't use chemicals to defoliate and then we mechanically harvest. And so you take a whole year, you know, to plant and grow a crop and, you know, see it come to full harvest, which is very rewarding. But in the meantime, parallel and tandem to that, the brands and retailers are, you know, by that time that cotton is harvested in November and December, it won't get to the spinning mill until, you know, February, March, turned into products. So it's actually another year before that cotton turns into products and goes through a yarn and a knitting and a weaving and a spinning process. And so the supply chain and the supply network that cotton goes through is extremely long and goes through a lot of different hands. And so it's going to have a separate mill for spinning into yarn. It'll go to a mill, a different mill that is knitting or weaving those t-shirts or that pair of jeans that you're wearing. It goes to a different place for cut and sew and to a different place to be, you know, dyed and finished and packaged and eventually to the brand and then off to the consumer. So from seed to a pair of jeans that you can wear is about a two-year process. So it's a long and lengthy supply network. When you're working with the entire supply network, then you've got to be able to think flexibly and holistically across the whole situation.
And historically, the whole cotton production increased with the invention of the ginning machine. What is the ginning machine? What does it do exactly?
Well, the Whitney ginning, obviously before that, when you think about an orange, you peel the orange and then it comes off in sections and it may have seeds. Well, a little cotton bowl is very similar. It's going to open and that lint in the cotton will have to dry out. But by weight, about 80% of that yield is actually seed. And so the seed have to be separated from the cotton. And a lot of time that was done by hand with combs and things like that. So it, before that, it was, you know, hand grown, hand spun, you know, and woven in very small amounts. So having a gin that can actually separate the seed from the fiber did revolutionize the cotton industry around the world. And so now you see the infrastructure of a group of farmers, you know, in a 40 to 60 mile radius around one gin that will be ginning all of that cotton because they are large plants that, you know, handle a lot of cotton. It's not only important to have the land and the heat units in the right region for cotton, but you also have to have the infrastructure and have the gin in order to make it commercially viable.
I try to be as mindful as possible in my purchase.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I try to be a mindful consumer. I try to choose and buy clothing which is made out of natural fibers and almost always 100% cotton because it's natural. So what's wrong with just non-organic cotton?
Well, I think that it's not so much as what's wrong as what's right about organic cotton. Organic cotton takes you on a journey with more regenerative practices. that eliminates the use of toxic and persistent pesticides. Right now, conventional cotton will use synthetic fertilizers in order to maximize yields. Also, fungicides to treat the seeds. Many times, herbicides will be used, especially when we talk about genetically modified cotton situations. And then you have growth regulators, and you have insecticides for bugs. And so there's a lot of chemicals currently used in the production of cotton. So when you go to an organic system and a regenerative system, you're changing at the very baseline, the soils. You're enriching the soils with green manure crops or composting, and especially crop rotation. You're building an ecosystem and increasing your biodiversity because of crop rotations and insectary strips. So it is about promoting life in that soil and in that farm and in that community, because then you're creating the ecosystem and habitat for, you know, other bugs and good bugs and the beneficial insects that take care of your pests and problems. And so it is about building a system around life in the soil, life in the community, life for that farm and for that farm family. And so I think it's about the positive things that organic production systems bring to agriculture and the communities.
So you're a fifth generation cotton farmer.
Indeed. Been a while in our family.
Talk about your journey in creating Textile Exchange. How did that come about? Wasn't your family tempted to use the high yielding seeds and the pesticides, which in a jiffy got rid of all the bugs?
Well, fortunately, we lived in West Texas where we do get the hard freeze. So that does take the pressure, some of the pressures off the insects because of the hard freeze. But it also, again, like I told you, we don't have to defoliate, but you have to go back and understand. In part, I'm an organic farmer because I don't know any better. And I certainly will stay an organic farmer because I have 7 grandchildren. So it's part of my heritage as well as my legacy. So I had the blessings of being born into a very stubborn German, you know, farm family that we were stewards of the land. We had a different philosophical approach. And I remember when other farmers in the 1960s, I was a child and I was granddaddy's girl and we were walking around that, you know, we'd look at the soil and he's like, we are not going to spray the insecticides and the things that the other farmers are spraying. We're going to work with our land and with the cotton in order to be good stewards. Organic wasn't a word, you know, back then at that point in time. I remember testing the dirt, you know, he'd squeeze it to see how it was and did it have enough moisture to plant. And he'd smell, we have good dirt. It's healthy enough to eat. And he, as I got older, he said, you know, insecticide and pesticide and herbicide, these all have death. You know, we're talking and we need to promote life. So I have to say I was brainwashed as a child of how to be responsible stewards for the land and to take care of it. So it takes care of us. Growing up that way and knowing that you have other solutions and are there pheromone traps or because you're not killing the bugs, your good bugs are there too. And there'd be years when there was pressures and we would buy more ladybugs and do more, you know, beneficial insects to put out there. In fact, I will tell you, beware of a husband that comes in late in the evenings with a big burlap sack that says, how would you like to go for a moonlight drive? And you're like, because you're driving in the four-wheeler, reaching down into this big burlap bag with straw and millions of ladybugs crawling all over as you're throwing them out into the cotton. So
wow.
There are other ways, you know, for every two, there is a fro. And so it is about setting up that ecosystem and balanced habitat and taking advantage of what you need to put in as a support system for the crops that you're growing.
And I feel that there's a movement now to natural farming, even over and above organic farming.
Yeah, it's really growing. We're finding people that, you know, they may not want to be organic, but they want to adopt more holistic and regenerative farming practice. So I think that's one of the things that's rewarding for me, even though while organic agriculture may be a small percentage of what is grown, we were certainly the tip of the spear. So when you think of, you know, really making that point of impact and definition for consumers, but we have certainly influenced agriculture in a broader way. There are several more sustainable initiatives and programs and standards that are out there. You know, we started the enabling legislation in the late 1980s. Our farm was certified in 1991. And so I have to say it's good that we have people on the ramp toward more sustainable, responsible, organic, and regenerative. So it is about getting people on that track. And imagine what the difference could be, especially when we look at climate change, if every farmer really took care of their soils and started really aggressively and proactively reducing greenhouse gases, that would be phenomenal, you know, and then that next step could certainly be building that ecosystem and increasing biodiversity. We're very excited about the direction of travel and and hope that more consumers become supportive of organic and more regenerative agriculture.
So do you have heritage seeds that you use?
No, unlike food crops, those heritage seeds for cotton would yield a very short staple. In fact, in India, they have some heritage cotton as well that is very short staples. So for the mechanized spinning mills and high-speed spinning frames, cotton has gone through an extensive breeding program over the years in order to have the longer staple, better micronair, more consistency in the crops in order to, you know, have the finer fabrics and different things like that. And of course, you have some of the cottons that like Egyptian cotton and South Sea Island cotton and Pima that have the longer staples. But for the majority of the upland cotton, it has been bred now. So you have to use, you know, some hybrid seeds that have been bred for that quality to be available in commercial spinning mills and factories.
I think the cotton in India is called Desi cotton.
That's
right?
Exactly right. I was like, the name is slipping my mind, but yes. And so when you think of that, then it's only applications are really some hand spinning.
I have come across fabrics made out of Desi cotton. Mm-hmm. It's a different feel, but the weave is kind of interesting because it's not so fine and long.
It's got a lot of texture and life.
Exactly.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. The seeds that you use have been bred. So how is that different from the BT cotton, which is kind of demonized by
well,
everybody?
Yeah, there's traditional breeding programs where you literally cross-pollinate and it's selective, just like if you were breeding goats or sheep. Let's say that you want to have a herd of brown goats, or, you know, that you're going to select those out. So you're going to select the qualities and save the seeds that are generating the qualities that you want to see in the next generation. And so it's just traditional breeding programs like you're going to see in tomatoes that have certain qualities, or corn that has a certain quality. That would be traditional breeding mechanisms. When you talk about genetically modified organisms, it's taking the natural breeding program into a science-based practice where they literally splice a different kind of plant or a different species or different something into the DNA of a cotton plant. So in the case of genetically modified organisms, they've put in like things that fight insects, and probably one of the most common ones in the United States is for herbicide control, so they can overspray the cotton, and so Roundup or other herbicides can be oversprayed. So those are foreign to the natural process and breeding process of cotton. So there's traditional breeding, which is, you know, natural selection, which is practiced around the world and is totally okay and organic. Then there's what they're doing with the gene modifications of putting in a foreign matter into a plant.
That's the best explanation I've heard about the difference between natural breeding and the GMO, because I, as far as possible, try to buy non-GMO things, mm-hmm. heritage tomatoes and things mm-hmm. of that sort. And most people, they say, you know, things are always bred and crossbred, and I have not have a really good...
I'm totally all for polka dot goats, or, you know, and brown cotton that's naturally bred, or pink roses, or, you know, let's turn it into a purple carnation. There's all those things that are about natural breeding, and I'm all for that and the experimentation in my garden. But when you talk outside the natural scope, then yeah, you're interfering with nature.
One of the most important things after growing the cotton is trying to sell it. So, and the ginning, the farmers who gin in this facility, do they belong to a cooperative, or are they just individual people who, you know, just have job work done by this facility?
You know, it's really interesting, and it's all the above when you're talking about farmers in different regions. There's all around the world, there's farmers that are organized into cooperatives that, you know, the gin may even be a cooperative. And so farmers get together and meet the needs, you know, by working together with each other. Sometimes the gins are separately owned, and the ginners will contract with the farmers around to grow cotton. Sometimes the farmers are associated with a mill, and they've had a longstanding relationship and grow cotton in that geographic region. That's especially common in India. And so the farmers are grouped into various groups that are based upon a geography or a location in a specific area.